Tonight on Arena, we talk to Joni Mitchell's biographer, Anne Powers, and Kinds of Kindness, Horizon, and A Quiet Place are our films up for review. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RT Arena or see our lovely film reviewers live on TV on rte.ie/arena. Tonight is film review night and shortly we will get the views of aforementioned John Maguire and Cara O'Doherty. One of the films is by director of The Favourite, The Lobster, Poor Things, Yorgos Lanthimos. It's Kinds of Kindness, a three-part fable in film form. The first story follows a man who is completely controlled by his boss. He seems happy with the situation until his boss asks him to do something he finds abhorrent. In the second story, we meet a man whose wife has been missing. When she returns, he grows to believe it's not really his wife and sets out to show his unhappiness by pushing her to the brink. In the third story, we meet a woman who has been rejected by her sect, and she endeavours to win back their approval by finding a woman with special powers. The film has an all-star ensemble cast of Emma Stone, Jess Pelmans, William Defoe, Joe Alwyn and others. Earlier, I spoke to the director, Yorgos Lanthimos, and the star, Jess Pelmans, and I began with this question. This is a film that deals with themes of power and control and free will. Is it right that it was Albert Camus' play Caligula that inspired you to write the first of the three parts of the film, beginning with the death of RMF?
Yeah, its themes and its main theme just started making me think of similar situations in contemporary society, and then even further, how it would feel to show that in a very interpersonal level. Like in the first story, and then we came up with two more and made this film, this triptych.
And that idea of this complete control that Raymond has over Robert, how did it come about that you thought about this kind of benefactor-boss relationship with his employee?
Well, I mean, it was one of the most straightforward things, I guess, in the stories that we're writing. I think when you want to investigate those kind of relationships, the employee with boss kind of relationship is, you know, the first that comes to mind. And then, you know, to explore similar themes or others, you know, there's romantic relationships, then there's the group relationships and dynamics that you find in the third story. The boss-employee relationship is the first thing that comes to mind when you want to explore something like that.
Jess, how did you find playing the character of Robert, who is subservient to Raymond? But I wonder, is the character, how aware is the character of how subservient he is to his boss? Or is he happy in his life?
I think he was very happy. You know, there are many different ways to look at that relationship outside of the obvious one. But I think it was really working for both of them. But like anything, sometimes, you know, in some dynamic like that, there is a natural evolution and maybe things have to get more extreme. And I think that freedom was too much for him.
Yorgos, when you developed this first scenario, how did you work with your co-writer in developing the story and these ideas of power and the sense of free will into the other two stories?
I guess, like, very instinctively, like, we chose ideas that felt had certain kind of similarities with, you know, our first idea, but at the same time felt, you know, different enough that to include them and to explore this kind of dynamics and relationships in other situations. So, yeah, and after that, you just start building characters in the story, see how far you can go or how far your characters can go, and then you're faced with decisions that they have to make, so you make those decisions for them. So you just keep going until you feel like you have something that explores those kind of themes in an interesting way and in a way that allows then people to engage with them and ask their own questions and project their own feelings on them.
And obviously in the second one, Jess, where your character is the husband who is dissatisfied with the with his wife who was missing, and when she comes back that she's not like the wife he had expected, then it becomes very controlling and quite violent.
I think that's right. But then there are a million other ways to look at it too.
Well, I guess Daniel would think of it in a different way.
Yeah. Scary. Terrifying. You know? To think there's an imposter doppelganger of your wife living in your house. That's some scary shit.
There's Jess defending his character at the end. That was Yorgos Lanthimos and Jess Plemons talking to me earlier. And as I said, John McGuire and Cara O'Doherty have been watching this film. So John, this is the second Lanthimos film to reach us this year, yeah, after the great success of Poor Things, but very different. Poor Things was such a Victorian,
yeah,
stylized film, whereas this,
yeah, we're not in fantasy London of the 18th century anymore. This is contemporary America, made up of drab office buildings and palatial mansions and cramped motels, and we're in cozy little kitchen nooks, and it's all very familiar but also eerily liminal. Lanthimos is really good at creating atmospheres from strange places or ordinary places and making them strange. And I mean, it's right from the start, right from the get-go in this film, he's drawn a definitive line between the Victoriana of Poor Things and contemporary America. But the first thing we hear is Sweet Dreams Are Made of This, the Eurythmics song, pounding electro song, as a fast car zooms into a driveway of a mansion. And it's very much a split between that was that and this is this. And it's in those kind of places that he stages these three kind of dark and inky fables about control, I felt. He's in your interview there, he's talking about relationships, but they're not really relationships. It's really about control and coercion.
Yeah, dig into that first relationship between Raymond and Robert.
Well, this is the crux of it, really, is that the relationships, one is corporate, one is marriage, I suppose, and the other is religion. Mm-hmm. And there are the three great themes of American cinema. And in the first one, the corporate one, which has a touch of the Old Testament about it. I mean, there's a Book of Job kind of thing going on here. There's some kind of religious vibe to all the stories, but this, yes, one in particular.
And he loves his master, even though his master is very cruel
to him.
Very
cruel to him, but also very kind to him. Plemons plays this uptight corporate drone, a guy called Robert, and his overbearing billionaire boss. We don't actually know what they do or what the business is. That isn't explained to us. He's Raymond, who's played by Willem Dafoe, and he controls every element of his life. And in return for that, for giving up his agency, Robert is given a big house and a flash car. He has a priceless collection of sporting memorabilia, which is quite hilarious, actually, in it. It's a good joke. And he's given a wife, Sarah, who's played by Hong Chow. And every morning, Robert receives written instructions on an index card, what to wear, what to eat, when to eat it, what to do, what to say, even when to have sex. Everything about it is controlled. And when he's ordered, then as part of this ongoing process, we don't know how long it's been going on. It feels like a long time. But eventually, he's been pushed to a point which I'm not going to reveal, which he will not cross. There's a line there. He's cast out. So exiled. But that exile proves unbearable to him, and he must abase himself in order to get back into Robert's good graces.
So let's listen to a clip that shows that dynamic between the William Dafoe character Raymond, he's the boss and benefactor to Jess Plemons, and the character Robert, and we'll see the level of control Raymond has over him.
Good afternoon, Robert. Don't just stand there, sit down. Were you waiting long?
No. 15 minutes or so.
Your hair's nice like that. Don't get it cut. Let it grow a little longer. And you've lost more weight, I think. Skinny men are the most ridiculous thing there is. We've gone over this before. You must put on a few pounds. I told you that last time.
But I have.
You most certainly have not. You're even skinnier now. We'll have to take another look at your eating plan for the week.
Carrot, that is a pretty creepy scene. And then we get on to the second scenario, the second story. And they are told independently, we have the same ensemble of actors playing very different roles.
So independently that each film, each segment ends with credits. So they're almost three short films within one. So in this, Plemons plays Daniel. He's an average police officer living in an average house, but his wife has vanished. She's played by Emma Stone. Her name is Liz, and she's a marine biologist, and she appears to be lost at sea. And he is so bereft that he's seeing her everywhere. He's even a prisoner in the police station. He's like, she looks a bit like... so he's really, I mean, he's devastated. But when she comes back, she's acting a little bit different. She was lost at sea. She's been through trauma. Her colleagues are still missing. So, you know, she's bound to be a little bit different.
Now, her shoes don't fit, though.
That's the thing. Her shoes don't fit. So, you know, maybe her feet swelled at sea. You know,
good point.
Yeah. And you would really think that Daniel would just be happy to have his wife back. But no, he starts sort of pushing the boundaries to test her in ways that, I suppose, again, would be a spoiler to say, but they're pretty brutal. They're pretty graphic. They're pretty awful. And
he's grumpy. He goes up to bed and he just grumps. He just, and then asks her to do despicable things.
And the weird thing is that she does them. So is she doing them because she's been, you know, deranged by the sea? Is she doing them because it's not her that, you know, has somebody else taking over? Like, what is going on? And the thing is, we don't really know. But it is very disturbing, very distasteful.
John, as Jess said in his interview with me, I mean, like, what's a guy to do? He thinks a doppelganger has taken over his wife.
I know, and that's in and of itself from, and now Plemons won Best Actor at Cannes for these three performances, this triptych. And yes, it's a good point from his point of view, but that story isn't really, he's the main character in it, but it's not really his story. It's Emma Stone's story. It's this, who is she? Where has she come from? Where has she been in the absence of time? And is she different? Is it him? Is he losing his mind? Or is she truly an imposter and a doppelganger and a skin wearer, you know, a kind of a supernatural character that's been dropped into this very ordinary, very everyday situation.
Is there control in this one?
There is, very much so. And there's a brilliant joke early on. There's two other characters that that appear in all three. One is played by Mamadou Athy and the other is played by Margaret Qualley, and they appear in all three films. And in this one, they're a married couple and they go over to spend some time with Daniel the cop and take his mind off things. And there is a super joke. It's an outrageous joke. We're not going to ruin it, but it is an outrageous joke. So you can tell that there has been some kind of an odd dynamic in this marriage already. Mm-hmm. And that even these two people who are part of the odd dynamic find it to be a bit too creepy now and are reluctant to revisit it. So there is, all this stuff is happening off stage, of course. But the story really is centered on Emma Stone's character. Is she some kind of other being, or is she just, you know, somebody who's been forced to do things that she doesn't want to do in order to maintain a happy home and a regular marriage? And that's a really interesting question. He is asking interesting questions in all three films, I think.
Yes, while using some outrageous imagery.
Yeah, he's really going for it.
The third one then, that's a very interesting one, I think. It's this woman who's a member of a sect.
Yeah,
couple who are a member of the sect.
So again, yeah, it's Emma Stone once again. This time she's playing Emily, and she's partnered. We don't really know in what kind of a sense, but she is partnered with Plemons' character. They're sent on a mission to find this woman who has something special. And they set out, and it's almost like a business thing. It's very organized. They head out, they stay in a motel, and they go on these sort of excursions to find her. And when they're not,
the woman has special powers.
She has special powers. And there's a suggestion that they have an idea of what she might have. There's some qualities, so they're looking for those physical attributes, and a woman of a certain age. And they're not really having much success. So when they're not there, they're back at their cult. It is a cult, really, which is led by Willem Dafoe. He's a character called Ami, and he is this sort of charming, creepy cult leader figure. And it is a sex cult, but they're also quite obsessed with water and purity. And that sort of is, again, it's disturbing. It's Yorgos. He likes his odd moments. But one
and
of the,
are there issues of power again? Presumably, if there's if it's a sect.
There's a big issue there with Emily. She actually has, she's a child and she has a husband played by Joe Alwyn, and she has given them up to be in the cult, which she visits secretly. But something happens when she's there for a visit with Joe Alwyn's character, her husband. And again, we won't say what, but again, it is all about control. And the consequences of that, again, are they're quite terrible for her. But yeah, control is definitely a big thing running through all three of these.
Mm. Yes, I mean, there's an awful lot of stuff in this. There's like things you would go away moralising about or arguing with whoever you went to the cinema with. And then there are, you know, quite shocking images within it. Do you think it works overall?
Yeah, I did. I mean, every weird element and every unsettling element of the first two stories is repeated in the third story, which is the longest and, to me anyway, the most satisfying and the most complete. And I mean, they're talking about power and family and God, and food plays a big part and pressure plays a big part. And there are doubles and twins and doctors appear in all three. Dogs appear. There's hilarious car stuff. Emma Stone drives this big purple sports car in the third movie and she drives the hell out of it. And it's really funny. And there are all these dark jokes, but buried in the dark jokes, there are deep thoughts. And Lanthimos and the guy who co-wrote it with him, Eftimis Philippou, who wrote Dogtooth and The Lobster, the early films, they really are in America. They've made films in America before, but this is a film about America. Everything around them appears on the screen. Everything that they've been influenced by in the locations that they're in New Orleans, as it turns out, but it could have been anywhere. They kind of cram it all in there. Some of it works and some of it really doesn't work. But it's up to you to figure that out. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're presenting you with these odd, abstract, avant-garde ideas. And it's really up to you in the audience to figure out whether they're connecting or not.
What did it work for you, Cara?
No. I love Lanthimos and I have loved all of his films, no matter how weird and wacky and
did
disturbing.
It remind you of the earlier ones,
it
like
did,
Lobster?
But I think even in those, there is some element. There's a tiny flicker of warmth. There's a little bit of humanity and empathy. There's none of that in this. It is cold. It is stark. Terrible things happen to everybody. There is obviously there's a social commentary running through it, but it's just too. And I'm all for disturbing things, but there's no real payoff for it. But I also have a big problem with the amount of nudity. Now, I'm an equal opportunity nudie person. If everybody's naked, that's fine. But there's so many shots of young women in vulnerable positions naked. And I just think there's just too much of that. And it's a reoccurring thing that he's using more and more. And in this day and age, we don't need that anymore. Yeah, yeah. And I think that is problematic. And yes, he is saying that situations for women, the world is not fair. The world is an uneven place. But we don't need to see it portrayed that way. And I just find that deeply uncomfortable. I mean, if the rest of them were naked, fine, but not women in vulnerable positions over and over.
So stars out of five from you, Cara.
I mean, performance wise, it is. They're exceptional. And I mean, it looks amazing. Robbie Ryan has once again done a fantastic job. So technically, it's a fantastic piece of work. But 3 stars just for that.
Okay, 3 from you, Cara, and from you, John.
Well, I'm just amazed that you can go and see this in a multiplex. This is an art house film, and Lanthimos is bringing the art house and that sensibility to the multiplex with a starry cast. I mean, this is as starry as it gets.
Yes, it's with an Irish A-list production, of course.
And an Irish production. And they're in multiplexes all over the world with, you know, flash trailers and great posters and a big promotional poster. I think that's kind of amazing that these ideas and this kind of presentation of the ideas is available to everybody on your corner multiplex. So I think that's great. But his early films have an element of sincerity. You called it warmth. I would call it sincerity. They are sincerely held artistic ideas. And I didn't get that from this film at all. In fact, quite the opposite. I thought it was quite cynical in a lot of what it was doing and a lot of the ways that he was pursuing his ideas.
So in terms of stars.
So hurry up, Kay, you're saying. 3 stars for me.
Kindly.
Kindly. I would say 3 stars. Now, and you're saying hurry up. This film is a long movie as well. It's a big sit.
Tell me about
so you have to be aware of that.
5 minutes,
yeah.
So.
You have to be aware of that.
But
3 stars, it's pretty good, but it's not great.
All right, well, we'll go to a little short jaunt for the next one. Will we go to Kevin Costner's project, which is Horizon, an American saga, chapter one? Cara, tell us about this. I don't know, what is it, mountain he has taken climb?
It is absolutely. It's a mountain that he has put everything into. It's a story he's been trying to make since 1988, but he couldn't get the funding for. And eventually he's mortgaged his own ranch to make this work. It is epic, isn't an epic enough word for it. It is a saga, the first film of four, that tells the story of the development of the Old West, the frontiers. It's all focused on a town called Horizon, a town that's yet to be built, but this town is, it's a hope, it's a dream. And you have all of these different people, a wagon train coming from one direction, all these different people trying to get to Horizon. But Horizon is the home of the First Nations people and Apache tribe who lived there. So this is a story of two societies clashing in a big oldie fashioned Western saga.
So Cara there explains it very well. So tell me about
better
the groups.
Better than I would have figured it out while watching the film.
Now, there are these disparate groups who are involved in getting to Horizon. Uh-huh. They are, do they meet? Are they all connected up?
Some do and some don't. The Apache War Party attacks the town, savagely slaughters the settlers. This is not Dances with Wolves. This is a far more savage and brutal representation of the Native American people. And emerging from the smoke and ruins of that is the newly widowed Frances, played by Sienna Miller, and her daughter Lizzie, who's played by Georgia McPhail. And they're taken to safety by the late arriving Gephardt, who's played by Sam Worthington. He's this brave lieutenant in the US cavalry. And while we're watching that story, there's another woman fleeing for her life with a child. That's Jenna Malone's Ella, and she's reinvented herself in another half-built town somewhere else and hired a local saloon woman called Marigold, who's played by Abby Lee, as a babysitter for her child. And then Costner himself arrives, and we're going to be saying "and then" quite a bit because this goes on and on. Costner arrives as this kind of laconic, he calls himself a horse tramp. He's Hayes. I mean, beautifully dressed, impeccably dressed. They all are in this dusty Wild West. They're all absolutely beautifully costumed. And we follow the fortunes of him as he's involved in a confrontation and by the outlaws who are trailing Ellen, and he heads off with Marigold and they flee. And one more storyline. There's five broken mm-hmm. stories here. And so far, unconnected to anyone else.
I thought Kinds of Kindness was doing
I know. If you think this has a long title, wait until you actually see the film. So far, unconnected to anybody else, we follow the fortunes of this dusty wagon trail making its way west behind the clever and courageous pioneer, Van Weldon, who's played by Luke Wilson. And just as they're starting to make some progress on their journey, the Apache start circling them. So those are the five main strands of story that Costner's juggling with.
And do the Apaches get a good whack of the storyline, Cara?
So they do. And so for a start, there's a really interesting dynamic early on where there's a conversation between family where the chief has basically said that the younger men want to go out and defend their land. And the first attack is, it's horrifying. But they see what's happening to their other communities and they want to fight back. And there is that division even within their own tribe when they're saying the more you fight, the more white settlers are going to just keep coming. They're just going to keep coming. So they're really stuck in this trying to figure out how to navigate this. And later on, there's a great moment between Sam Worthington's character and Danny Houston, who's playing a soldier. And they're discussing and they're saying how that this can't, no matter what happens, this can't end well because the settlers aren't going to stop coming and they don't respect the fact that this is a land that already has its own people. So there's certainly, as Costner's saying, that he's not reinventing history. He's just trying to say what really happened. Some of the First Nations actors, they learn to speak the very particular Apache dialect because they're the White Mountain Apaches. And so there's a lot of attention to detail.
Let's listen to a clip which might throw some light. And maybe that's a bit pushing it a bit too far. Here anyway, Kevin Costner's character, Hayes Ellison, breaks up a brawl and gets into a grapple of his own. That.
You give this man your yard? I don't know why you standing in his way.
Well, maybe your friend ain't.
bloody enough for you.
Well, you don't stand in front of me. And you don't stand in front of him. You don't stand in front of us.
Well, if I move, then we're going to consider this over.
You be careful. Someone's going to take that gun and wrap you with it.
What?
Hayes, leave it as just words. Just words, Hayes! Hayes! Just words.
Okay, that's a punch. A sound effect with Hayes punching the other.
Me banging my head off the desk, Kay, is what it was.
Yeah, and me trying to make out what it's all about. So this is the first of three, John?
It's the first of four, actually, Mar. Yeah, Kay. He's apparently made the second one. The last 5 minutes, and this is not spoiling anything, the last 5 minutes of this film is a very hastily cobbled together trailer for the next film, which after you've watched three hours of hastily edited, badly cobbled together, multiple spanning storylines, then you're given this kind of short, like an old MTV blipvert, like a really short synopsis of what happens in the next 4 hours. And that's a dreadful mistake. But This is a film that is riddled with mistakes. It's an absolute folly right from the start. Nothing gets resolved. How could it? And we're set up for chapter two. It doesn't end. It goes into this trailer, like I said. But for many audiences, Kay, that trailer might all be all they ever see of part two.
Oh, because it might never be made.
No, it is made it and is it made. Will be. But nobody is going to want to go and see it.
Okay. Stars out of five from you, John.
Two. Because I like some of the actors and I like what they're doing. But I'd like to have focused on them a little more and actually gotten to know them as characters rather than suddenly you start in Wyoming, then you're in Montana, then you're somewhere else.
Cara, stars from you.
Look, it's a little rambly, but as a diehard Western fan, I was in my absolute happy place. And yes, these stories sort of meander around the place, but I could have sat there for another 3 hours. I was in love with it. It's not perfect, but I'm 4 stars for me.
And you're back for 3, 4 and 5.
Absolutely. Roll them on.
Love
me and my cowboys.
Why isn't this on TV, Kay? That's the question I had the whole time I was watching. It is perfect. There's 12 hours proposed to this. A 12 hour long TV show.
I'd say Kevin Costner would have a very long answer for that.
He's a man of the cinema.
Okay. So briefly now, A Quiet Place, day one. We've had two other Quiet Places. Where are we now, Cara, with A Quiet Place?
So in A Quiet Place 2, there's a minor character played by Digimon Hunzu. He's called Henry, and he makes a reference to surviving the first day of the attack when he was in New York. So this film brings us right back to New York, the very first wave of the invasion. It hasn't hit the Midwest where John Krasinski and Emily Blunt were living their lives. So it goes right back to the very first time when the aliens landed in New York and the consequences of that day.
All right. And do we get a good look at the aliens?
We do. Like, The Quiet Place, as always, we never really get a full up close. And I think that's part of the good thing that makes them extra creepy. We see big legs. We see big, scary faces. We see things running very fast. But we never get a really big up close to the whole thing, just to keep that kind of edge of, that's a creepy looking thing.
And John, do they find out pretty quickly that these guys are blind, so
yes,
they're
responsible for that. You have to stay quiet in order not to attract their attention within the first couple of minutes of this attack. Actually, you know, the initial attack is brilliantly staged. It really is. The effects are superb. The monsters are great. The sense of panic and fear that the director engenders is brilliant right from the start. And they very quickly figure out, listen, we have to be quiet, and they won't be able to hear us. Like the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park. If you don't move, they won't see you, they won't attack you. So staying alive means being utterly silent. So Sam, who's played by Lupita Nyong'o, and her cat make it through the initial onslaught, and then they join forces with another man, a guy who's absolutely terrified, an English stockbroker called Eric, played by Joseph Quinn, and together they want to make their way across New York City to a boat which is going to take them to safety,
so
where
the
Jumon Hunsu character is waiting for.
Is it more larks in this space, or does it add something to the story?
I don't know about prequels, first of all. I have an issue with prequels. I think A Quiet Place brought us into a mystery. And there's no real mystery here. We know where we're going. We know where this story is going to end up. Now, there are some really frightening sequences of flight and escape, as you'd expect, even if they're borrowing from Aliens and Jaws and Jurassic Park, like I said. And they're a bit more obvious this time around. But for me, the film struggles to balance those kind of genre-mandated thrills, which are very well executed, with the character work and the emotional work that's required. And it ties itself into knots. And none of that convinced me at all. But the monster stuff is great.
A star out of five from you, John?
2.5. I thought it was okay.
2.5. Cara?
Actually, I thought it was very good. I like the fact that it actually has quite a thinky element to it. There's a thoughtful element and you get your monsters. And the cat is amazing. So 4 stars for me.
4 stars from you. For that's for A Quiet Place, day one. The other film was Kind of Kindness and Horizon. John McGuire and Cara O'Doherty, thank you so much. All I Want There from Joni Mitchell's early masterpiece, the album Blue. The song gives the title to a new biography of the iconic singer-songwriter. Travelling on the Path of Joni Mitchell is the work of NPR music critic Anne Powers. It comes out after an unlikely comeback from the artist in the wake of a devastating brain aneurysm in 2015. The Newport Folk Festival in 2022 marked her return to performance, much altered but still an impressive presence on the stage. I'm delighted that Anne Powers is on the line from Nashville, and you're very welcome to Arena.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, almost the first thing you tell readers of Travelling is that it's not a typical biography. How would you make that distinction to a typical biography?
Well, for one thing, it tells the story of Joni Mitchell's life journey, but also my journey as a fan, a critic, someone assessing her legacy and following her, always a little bit ahead of me on the path. So there is that aspect, a memoiristic aspect, but also I make a lot of associative leaps. You know, I contextualize Joni's music and her life in terms of what was happening in the 70s with independent film, with feminist fiction, what was happening with the counterculture in the 60s. New wave in the 80s, you know, trying to touch all these different subjects that might not really fit in a conventional biography.
Yes. And so when you say it's called Travelling on the Path of Joni Mitchell, so you're kind of a super sleuth going after your prey, trying to find out what made her tick and not necessarily believing all the people you talk to.
Absolutely. A super sleuth or maybe a pilgrim on the trail, a pilgrimage. Either way, we can use either metaphor. But definitely thinking about Joni Mitchell, not just as an actual person who lived and lives or as an artist, but also as an icon, as a legend. And how do we absorb these iconic figures? How do we think about these iconic figures as they move through time?
Now, you, as we know, she's very much alive, as we saw her at the Newport Folk Festival. But you chose not to talk to her.
Yes. Initially, I thought, well, initially when I started the project, honestly, she wasn't really in a condition to do interviews. It was shortly after the aneurysm. But as time went on and the book, the structure of the book took shape, I realized that I wanted to be able to discuss topics and make associations that couldn't be dictated by, you know, what happens in an official biography when the subject really dictates the narrative. You know, I needed room to challenge Joni Mitchell's legacy, challenge her sometimes, even as I love and celebrate it. So those were some of the reasons why I made that decision.
Yes, yes. And there's a lot of fun with the interactions you have with people you talk to about her and what you might think of what they said. Now, Roberta Joan is the name that she was born with, Roberta Joan Anderson. And bring us back to that childhood. What did you find out in your sleuthing or in your pilgrimage of what that childhood was like?
Well, in her music, we discover Roberta Joan through the voice and mind of Joni as a kind of a dreamy country girl hanging out on the prairies, the Canadian prairies where she grew up. I mean, that's true, but also she was a suburban kid. She was a kid of that generation that invented the counterculture, you know, a little bit older than the baby boomers, as we think, but steeped in jazz and classical music because that's what her parents played at home, a tomboy, a kid who really always wanted to move on beyond the suburban life that she led as a very young child. And then as a high schooler, she was, you know, exploring. She was fancied herself a young bohemian in many ways, and soon took off on her own path.
Yes, and there's wonderful descriptions, I suppose, imagined by you of that path, of getting on buses and moving, of meeting fellow musicians on buses or in bus stops, learning, you know, tuning her guitar, other people yes. copying things she saw. Give us an idea yes. of the wonderful milieu she was in there, which was both creative and I guess punishing all this journeying.
Absolutely. Well, you know, when she first started playing music, she started on a ukulele, interestingly enough. That was the instrument her mother would buy her, soon graduated to a small version of a guitar. But she was in Calgary in Alberta and playing clubs like the Depression, where she would have seen all kinds of people passing through, blues players and you know, calypso players and people playing vaudeville music, all kinds of music. And she's absorbing all of that. She also thinks of herself as a painter. You know, she went to the Alberta College of Art and Design, thought she might be a fashion illustrator or a commercial illustrator at first, just to make a living. But I think painting really infused her sensibility very early on and remained kind of a guiding principle in her songwriting techniques.
Yes, but I think she found a lot of the teaching in the art college a bit bossy or over-structured. And that's kind yes. of why she went to music more.
Yes, I think that is one of the reasons. Also, she's said many times she did not like the abstract expressionists, which she felt her teachers preferred to her favorites like Van Gogh and the other impressionists. So she was always on her own path. I also think playing music created, you know, it offered her a different kind of community. And quickly she, you know, she was getting on those buses and going to the Mariposa Folk Festival, eventually moving to Toronto, where she lived in Yorkville, which was the bohemian enclave at the time. And you know, hung out with all kinds of different people and just was growing up, you know, 20 years old.
From Canada, then she set off to New York and then set out to LA and the Laurel Canyon in the late 60s. And we might talk about the men in her life, the collaborators, musical collaborators, the David Crosby, the Graham Nash, the James Taylors, people you spoke to for the book. But you took yes. what they said with more than a pinch of salt, didn't you, Anne?
Well, I think the thing is, I have a line in the book and I say something like, something like apology is one way older men rejuvenate themselves. One thing I noticed as I was talking to all of these fellows is that they are very quick to put Joni at the top of the pantheon, you know, the ultimate, better than them. That's what they say now. And they admired her and really revered her even when she was young. But let's face facts, there was a double standard back in those days and men had such a huge advantage. So it was interesting, like when I met the late David Crosby, I got to interview him luckily before he passed away. And he was definitely in full apology mode, talking about how at the time he should have, you know, tried to form a band with Joni or given her, you know, even more than he gave her then. And you know, he had learned that lesson over time to become the feminist man he was at the end of his life. But sometimes it takes time, doesn't it?
Yes, because you recall the Rolling Thunder tour that she took yes. part in with Bob Dylan and that scene yes. in it where she's introducing Coyote. And
yes.
Just recall that for us, would you, Anne?
Yeah, it's you can see it. It's featured in Martin Scorsese's Rolling Thunder documentary. It's quite amazing because she's teaching them or trying. She's trying to teach Bob Dylan and Robbie Robertson how to play Coyote. They're at Gordon Lightfoot's house. And both of them are just hanging on by the skin of their teeth trying to follow along. I mean, the challenge that she's posing them just in her open tunings, her style of finger picking, and of course, her incredible vocals that few could match. I think that this is what always happened with her male collaborators. They really had to catch up with her and learn her language in order to play with her, and they benefited so much.
Okay, let's listen to Joni Mitchell in a passionate form. Here's A Case of You.
You're in my blood like holy wine. It tastes so bitter and so sweet. Oh, I could drink a case of you, darling, and I would still be on my feet. Oh, I would still be on my feet.
A Case of You there from Blue, and I'm talking to Joni Mitchell's biographer, Anne Powers. And there were a number of missteps along the way. Can you bring us into this alter ego of hers, or persona of hers, Claude, or Art Nouveau, and how, what a wrong step it was?
Yeah, well, this is a episode in Joni Mitchell's life, or an aspect of her art making and her persona making that many people don't know about, even though it was right hidden in plain sight, or actually not hidden at all. In the mid-70s, she was invited to a costume party and was walking along, I think, Hollywood Boulevard, and passed a black man on the street, an African-American man, and was so inspired by their exchange. They had a brief, you know, hello exchange and his style that she went into a costume shop, purchased an Afro wig, purchased some brown makeup and a fedora hat, later borrowed a suit from a friend and became this character. We would call that, many people would call this wearing blackface. In her case, I think she thought of it as manifesting a part of herself. She not only did this at the costume party, which astoundingly, she has claimed that no one recognized her at that party and others have backed her up, but appears as Art Nouveau on the cover of her album, Don Juan's Reckless Daughter. I should say, just this year, she has reissued that album with a different cover, using a different image. So even though she's never renounced this character of Art Nouveau, mm-hmm. that seems to be a signal in some ways that perhaps she's thought better of it now. But the character lived on for many years, and no one really took her to task very much for it. I think we're living in such a different time now, and it's time to face, you know, what this really was.
Traveling is the name of your book. And of course, one of the downsides of traveling is loneliness. I want to go into playing some of River, and you do talk about how it captures that notion of loneliness.
Absolutely. Loneliness is melancholy, is a key quality in Joni Mitchell's music. I think I talk in the book about sadness and melancholy as a kind of a form of resistance for women, a way of signaling their dissatisfaction at that time, especially in the early days of the second wave of women's liberation, signaling their dissatisfaction with the way men treated them, with the double standards, with the limits that were placed around her, and so often around them, and so often in Joni Mitchell's songs, there is this fundamental tension between the desire to be intimate with men, to create a home, and the need to follow through on her own creative ambitions. And I think in River, which is really a song about breaking someone's heart and having your heart broken by the act of breaking someone's heart, there is that sense of the need for motion and freedom, but also an understanding of the cost.
Let's listen to River now.
Oh, I wish I had a river I could skate away on. I made my baby cry.
My thanks to Anne Powers, and her book is Travelling on the Path of Joni Mitchell, and it's published by HarperCollins. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Leah Murphy and Barbara Rose Sanwo. Harry Buckless was on sound. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator. Tonight's show was produced by Nasa McLaughlin, and John Creedon is next after the news at 8.